Shrink Wrap Radio Number 52, September 13th, 2006, Religious Delusions. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
But it also has caused me to reflect very much on what faith is and how much sometimes I think a lot of what passes as religion is in fact an excuse to avoid dealing with mental illness. And for me, it's that which sets us apart from others is automatically, in my thinking, a delusion.
That which sets us apart from others is automatically a delusion. That very provocative thought comes from the Reverend Christopher Heath, who is an Anglican priest in the south of Australia. He's chaplain for Bloomfield Psychiatric and Orange Base hospitals in the Anglican Diocese of Bathurst, New South Wales. This interview comes to us by way of Frank Small, our psychological correspondent from Down Under, who's got himself a new MP3 recorder and whom you may recall from some earlier episodes. Going to Reverend Heath's website, I discover some commonalities in our backgrounds. We've both studied electrical engineering, we've both practiced yoga, and we've both been amateur radio operators, or hams. And I also see we're both Macintosh fans, so he's okay in my book. More importantly, though, as I listened to the interview, I really found myself resonating with his ideas about the essence of spirituality as opposed to the trappings of it, as well as his timely and thoughtful reflections on the divide between Christians and Muslims. Here's the interview.
How would you like me to address you?
Christopher is fine.
Christopher?
Christopher is fine, yes.
And what's your official title?
My official title is the chaplain at the Orange Base Hospital and Bloomfield Psychiatric Hospital in Orange. And I'm an Anglican priest, and I've been 29 years in full-time parish ministry prior to coming to Orange. Mm-hmm. I actually trained and did some units of CPE in 1977.
What's CPE?
CPE is Clinical Pastoral Education, and worked at the New Flinders Medical Centre in Adelaide. That's really an exercise in doing pastoral ministry within a hospital, within a clinical situation, mm-hmm. where you reflect on your pastoral encounters with a supervisor in order to gain some insights as to how you are operating and how also you're affecting the person in the bed. Parish ministry has always been good, but after 29 years, it's good to have a change. I've enjoyed wherever I've been. And I've been grateful for the journey on which I've come, and just to have a pastoral ministry is a wonderful thing because you meet so many interesting people. Because I operate as the chaplain at the Orange Base Hospital, I see everyone, regardless of what faith they have or what faith they don't have, and to be a friendly face and to be a listening ear, to be open to where they're at and their own concerns, and that's remarkably very welcomed by the people that I see. Obviously, people of no faith still appreciate being noticed and are happy. I obviously don't talk about religion much.
You're also the chaplain at Bloomfield, which is the largest mental health institution west of the Blue Mountains.
Yeah.
Your role there is to...
A similar role. That's been, in some sense, a learning experience. I had some contact with the Mood Disorders Association in South Australia for various reasons. So I have had an interest in mood disorders, which is is different from mental illness in that sense, technically. But it also has caused me to reflect very much on what faith is and how much sometimes I think a lot of what passes as religion is in fact an excuse to avoid dealing with mental illness. I would see much of what passes for Christianity defines who Christians are as opposed to someone else. And a lot of what I see in terms of mental illness sets individuals up as a guru, a person who is set apart from other people, some sort of an election or whatever. So they're actually fairly parallel sort of paths. And so the difference between a mental illness and a religious delusion actually is very hard to define. And for me, it's that which sets us apart from others is automatically, in my thinking, a delusion.
Mm-hmm. So it's an in-group, out-group, that us and them situation where...
That's interesting to me because we live in a world of terrorism, of very much them and us. And also the realisation since I've come to Orange, though perhaps the seeds of it were before I came to Orange, that in fact the religious delusion is actually far more dangerous. The person who's religiously deluded is far more dangerous than the person who has a mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
Because in fact they have the ability to affect the behaviour of others through their faith teaching to actually cause others to set themselves up as apart from others.
Mm-hmm.
The things that the religious churches do is actually exclude people. And so a lot of what passes for Christianity, mainline Christianity even, is a division between how we are different from the rest of the world. You know, those Muslims who follow jihad and things like that, where other people are expendable. And that's where it becomes dangerous. The people generally at Bloomfield who have those sorts of things are generally nice people. They really actually don't hurt many other people. They might hurt themselves. It's the people who actually are in positions of power and authority who do.
Mm-hmm.
I see people getting over their delusions through adhering to a drug therapy and that seems good and some clear thinking. But the problem with religious delusions is that people just don't believe, they believe they're on the right track. And Christians as much as Muslims, please, I'm not talking about...
Oh, it's regardless of which religion, it covers all of humanity, wouldn't it?
Yes, And often people who have a religious delusion feel they have to convert the world. And a lot of so-called evangelical Christians want to convert the world. And it's a horrible lie. And I wouldn't worship the God who put that upon me or tried to put that upon me.
Mm. Is that in line with the passions that you hold in your daily job?
Yes. My passions in my daily job are that our atonement with God is dependent on our atonement with other people. So that true religion is actually about embracing other people who are different. And that through that, there comes atonement with God. In fact, atonement with God is less important than our atonement with other people, our being at one with other people. So anything that sets Christianity as opposed to something else, whether it be Muslims or Jews or Buddhists or Hindu or gays or lesbians or, you know, women in power, that opposition ultimately for me says that's a delusion.
Yeah.
It's a fairly profound statement.
I was thinking about the verse and chapter, you know, where one of the disciples of Jesus comes up and says, you know, how many times should I forgive my brother?
Yeah.
Seven times a day is not enough. So seven times 70 and even then it's not enough. And Moses and love thy neighbour, it all's along that line.
Yeah.
I've seen you in action at work. I've seen that you're very, very approachable.
Yes. And that's part of that's the working out personally of being at one with those people with whom you see who are in the detox unit, just being a friend. But it shows that here is somebody in authority who cares. There's a lovely, lovely story about Pope John the 23rd, and he's my favourite person, who once went to a prison, you know, and it was unheard of that a pope would ever go to prison, you know. Just a beautiful story about how he went and just talked to people. And I don't know how many lives he changed, you know, but he at least went, and he showed them that they were still children of God, whatever they'd done. And to me, that's you start to see some of the passion in my work. And if I can do that, then I'm content. Mm. Well, for me, that atonement with other people is the key that opens it all up to do that expanding. For me, the reason why Jesus was killed was because he associated with others, the people who weren't religious, the tax collectors and sinners.
And the... Yes. Yeah,
the other
Gentiles.
Yes, yeah. And the Gentiles and yeah. Whoever, yes. And while the traditional Christianity says, you know, that Jesus was killed because he was claimed to be the Son of God, that's actually the excuse that those who killed him gave.
I've learned a lot about stigma and stigmatisation.
Yep.
And being guilty via association, even walking into the premises yes. of a psychologist or a counsellor,
yes.
automatically infers that you're nuts. And I can see the relevance where you were just talking about with Jesus associating with the others, mm. how that's a guilty by association.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, the religious people wanted Jesus just to associate with them yeah. and support their little delusion of the truth. Because Jesus was killed for associating with others, the resurrection is the guarantee that that continuing association of the living God with other people continues. And part of my passion comes from the realisation of how much more there is. That, you know, the more I talk to other people, the more I'm blessed. It's interesting, as I've moved into Bloomfield, which is quite the most interesting part of my work, the psychiatrists, the psychologists, the doctors, the nurses, and then you have the social workers, the occupational therapists, the diversional therapists, the activities nurse, you have the chaplains, you have the domestics, you have the people who do the food, the linen, the administration, the HR, the occupational health and safety people. You have all of these people around trying to help lift a person to their feet. And I think, isn't that amazing? Because as I read the Bible, time and again, when people fall down before God in awe and wonder, God lifts them to their feet. And to me, that means more than how we walk from here across the park, but it means that our primal dignity as human beings to stand on our own two feet rather than grovel, and also to use our brains rather than just conform and obey. That won't be taken from anyone. So for me, as I look at the hospital and these people who in times past would have been dismissed, locked away, or whatever, here they have this whole system. I mean, it's hard work for everyone. Mm-hmm. But to me, if you want to know where I think God's at work, I think God's at work at Bloomfield in the doctors and nurses and all those other people that I said. Mm-hmm. And whoever I missed out on, you know. Mm-hmm. And they're doing God's work because they're lifting somebody to their feet, or trying to. And that's lovely to see. Mm. And it's lovely to be a part of. You know, an occupational therapist will help a particular patient just out of it now, just choosing one out of it. What lies behind it is a care, a desire to help this person in getting gainfully employment. Now, that may or may not happen. They, you know, all your efforts to help a person be gainfully employed may not bear fruit. What lies behind it is the care. But I actually also try and step back and not do things, you know, not become a therapist. Because I somehow want to say it's me here, caring for you there. Not because other people don't, but because it can get lost perhaps in the therapy that is legitimately being attempting. I mean, you know, being brought to bear or to help this person. The occupational therapists don't stop doing what they do and start simply caring for the person, but because the, you know, people do need, you know, that help to get be gainfully employed. And that's an interesting exercise to see that it's me that's called to be there for another person. If Jesus just wanted me to repeat parrot fashion John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son that whoever believes in him should not perish, have everlasting life, he could actually get a whole lot of Mac computers and get them to or train a whole lot of parrots. But it's me that's called to stand alongside these people because I care. It's that care, it's that, it's me that's there. Do appreciate having somebody who comes along and gives them perhaps just a couple of minutes of their time, and that there's a system that enables that to happen. The church has this sort of myth that the world out there is irreligious, but you know, all of these people have their God, and they have their view, they have their perceptions of something. And they need those perceptions affirmed, and they need to be encouraged. And I'm happy to come and do whatever. You know, yeah. It's interesting because it, you can say, "Well, it's not me, and yet it is me." Dorothy Rowe. Do you know Dorothy Rowe? She's a psychologist from England, who's very critical of religion, mainly because the religion with which she's been familiar has been negative and repressive. She talks about the importance of being positive and the importance, and I'm sorry, I'm probably doing a disservice here and I apologise to her in advance, but she very much believes in the innate ability of people to be positive and to overcome depression and things like that. You know, anything that diminishes people is demonic. Anything that lifts people up is of God for me. So that there's something about physical contact which is important, which makes that connection, and it can't be just intellectual, and that's particularly difficult in my situation and in circumstances that we find ourselves in the church at the moment. But part of the ritual of giving communion is a physical thing. Part of the anointing for the sick is a physical way of making physical connection. And I believe that's very important. A lot of, when I am praying with people, it's in the hospitals, more in the base perhaps than at Bloomfield, I try and at least hold their hand. There's an importance of physical touch that brings that connection and is supportive and caring and positive. I hope it's supportive, and I hope it's seen as supportive and caring and positive rather than invasive and manipulative.
How does having that belief help people in recover from grief or recover from situations in day-to-day life, even if a family member has a mental illness? How does that belief help them?
It's interesting to me that often in the Gospels, Jesus will say to a person, "Your faith has made you well, not my power has made you well." One of the things is if we look at our faith as a bulwark against difficulties or illness, then that is actually self-focused. It's focused on ourself. As such, it's not really what God's about. God's about us becoming at one with the people around us. becoming at one with the people around us enabled the healing skills of the doctors and the nurses and all of the people around about them. Within the wider context of the world, if you see your faith as opening yourself to the joys and the contributions that people of different faiths make, then there is a possibility for world peace. Whereas if you separate yourself off from others, then the possibilities for world peace are considerably lessened. So if you open yourself to the contributions of the people that God puts around you in hospital, the possibilities for health and wholeness are considerably enhanced. Not guaranteed, but enhanced.
Mm.
Because we all die at some stage. So empirically, I can't give you guarantees, yeah. but I know, I mean, I don't have to convince you of those truths,
mm-hmm.
because you know them within yourself. It's a bit like anger. If you dwell on anger, it only gets worse. If you dwell on the devil, as often people who are mentally ill do, then you only magnify the importance of that. The essence of what I've already said is that God wishes us all to stand on our own two feet, to use our brains, to think for ourselves, to not cower, to not conform, to be creative, to become all the person that everyone wants us, all the potentialities that lie within us, to have them fulfilled. That's what God for me is about.
I was thinking about when you were talking about it's organisations are humans helping other humans,
yes.
and you're really talking in this collectivist outlook where we're all connected through our actions.
Yes.
Nowadays, it's very hard to sort of find that in the media.
Well, perhaps it's because the media is become so pervasive. And often they focus on the negative, whereas before they weren't quite as pervasive. It's interesting also, I find that incredibly profound. They will say, you know, the thing that really has helped me are the other patients. Mm. And I think, hey, you know, this is being at one with other people in the same boat, and how powerful that is. I mean, we are all different. We're all meant to be different. It was interesting that I've just been to a conference of chaplains up at Brisbane, and they had speakers from the Jewish faith, from Islam, from an Aboriginal spirituality, and also a Buddhist. And one of the commentators said, you know, you start to think, you know, well, you know, there are so many differences between people. Perhaps the differences are not an aberration, you know, sort of where God's actually failed, but it's actually, you know, God's meant it to be.
Mm.
And that's an astonishing statement, you know. You know, coming from, you know, a good Church of England, you know, where everyone had to be white, Anglo-Catholic, Church of England, you know what I mean? Straight and... And differences was never, and of course, if we were all the same, it would be so easy to love everyone.
It'd be boring.
Well, it used to be boring, but it would be so easy.
Yeah.
And love's not easy.
It's easy to hate, though.
Yeah, it is. Well, I'm not sure. It depends on how you look at it, of course, but.
It's always easy traveling downhill than it is up.
Yeah, something like that. It's interesting. I've been, you know, thinking, and I think a lot about the church, and much of my thoughts is, you know, often the church has gone through various reformations. I don't want the church to be reformed. I want the church to open itself to the world. There's a wonderful story about the 99 sheep, you know, and the one who goes off. And every time I've heard that exegeted, the church is the 99, and somebody wanders off from the church, so, you know, God brings the person back to the church. The numbers are wrong. The world are 99. And it's the people in the church who go off by themselves thinking they're better. And Jesus brings them back to the world. And that, you know, that's for anyone who's religious, that is scandalous.
I was just thinking, if it was 100 years ago, you'd be burnt.
Yes, that's right, yes. But Jesus came to bring the religious back to the world. That's why he was crucified. Because he did it in the name of God.
Yeah. It's just interesting where I don't know whether it was on a movie or something like that. I don't know, where a little kid asks a mother, why are there so many different colours in the world? Yeah. Everybody's got different skin colours. Yeah. It's the same with attitudes, behaviours.
That's right.
Theories of life and beliefs. So God likes to paint with many colours. Mm. How boring would a painting be with it if it only had one colour?
Yeah.
There are lots of ways to avoid loving. The church has many of them. One of the most recent ones is to challenge other people. And so rather than love them, we challenge them. I have a hate of the word challenge. It only appears once in the Bible, and that's because somebody challenges God, because the root of challenge actually is a fight. It's not actually, the mountains there of challenges to climb it. It's not at all. That's a modern use of the word challenge. So one of the things that the church often does rather than love people is to challenge other people. And they think they're doing God's will. So a lot of my theology finds itself in critiquing the church, and how it is in fact an unloving, abusive place.
Mm.
And I've said in from the pulpit, we know what the problem with pedophiles are. They believe they're loving somebody who's a minor, and it's actually manipulating them and dominating them. But that's what the church wants to do all the time, in the name of God.
Mm.
That's not
quite
love.
Strong words, yeah.
Yes, well, they're in my sermons. I'm not just saying it because we need to make sure that our love actually is means something, and it's not self-seeking.
See, it's like that with the studies, Although psychology, all they can do at the moment is operationally define what love is. They can't say what is love.
Yeah.
These endorphins are floating through the body, and this is what happens, behaviourally. What happens up here in the mind, it's another thing. They don't know that. With the studies that have shown, the human can fight off diseases fast, they recover from behavioural problems faster, like depression, anxiety.
Yes.
It's almost as if God has said, those that love will heal yourself and faster.
Yep.
The body's designed in the way to work at its most optimum.
Yes.
When it works around love.
Yeah. Well, again, healing comes through being at one, and I'm sure that's the healthiest way to be. Yes, I don't have. I'm quite convinced of that, and it gets back to that physicality, that touch, how important that is, and can't just be intellectual or emotional, whatever. It has to be physical too.
All right.
Well,
how does that sound?
Thank you very, very much.
It's my pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this chat between Frank Small and the Reverend Christopher Heath. I particularly resonate with his call for greater tolerance and his hard-headed notion that some people use religion as a way of avoiding dealing with their own mental problems. I also liked his provocative statement that Jesus came not to bring religion to the world, but to bring the religious back to the world. I find Christopher to be a provocative and original thinker, turning long-accepted ideas on their head and bringing a new understanding to them. His call for greater tolerance and understanding is certainly timely. We need to focus on what we have in common rather than on our differences. Personally, it absolutely boggles my mind that in some sense we're off fighting the Crusades again, still, that the different lines of the offspring of Abraham are killing one another. Come on, this is getting old. To shift gears, we've touched a bit on various people helping careers in previous episodes. Listening to Christopher Heath, I realized that becoming a chaplain might be a good fit for many people who might not have ever considered that career path. Clearly, Christopher is in a good position to provide listening, empathy, understanding, and counsel to people who are struggling with a wide range of psychological problems. In fact, he's part of the mental health team at the hospitals where he works. In some ways, he seems less encumbered by the, quotes, professionalism, close quotes, that often accompanies becoming a psychiatrist or a clinical psychologist. He comes across as a warm, non-judgmental man who would be easy to open up to. I can imagine that he's quite an effective counselor. I appreciated his remarks, which seemed to be emphasizing the importance of just being very present for the other person as a caring human being, creating as little separation as possible. Unfortunately, I think too much professional training can tend to lead toward that separation between therapist and client. I spent a total of 8 years in graduate school working toward a PhD. Now, part of the reason it took that long is that I went for a master's degree first. After 8 years in a doctoral program, it can be challenging to relate to the average person in the street without coming off stilted, distancing, or just hyper-educated. At the time I was in school, there was no master's degree level licensing for people who wanted to become therapists. The doctoral degree was the only route. But the doctoral degree is designed largely to train researchers, which is more about distance and objectivity than really getting down with another person. I think good therapists are born. Some people just naturally have the gift, perhaps due to being sensitized by early wounds in their own lives. For whatever reason, some people clearly have the gift and others don't. I think some training can help to refine the gift, but too much training can also get in the way of that gift. So even though I have a PhD, I think master's level training for counselors and therapists is probably better than trying to push them all toward PhDs. There's some research from years ago that found a correlation between therapist effectiveness and experience. In other words, a lot of the learning happens on the job, and with more experience, therapists and counselors get better. A really interesting finding that I recall from the same piece of research is that the therapist's effectiveness was correlated with experience, but not with theoretical orientation. Therapists may talk very different theoretical perspectives, but the longer they've been in the field, the more similarly they tend to practice.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
Okay, we have a couple of listener emails to share. First, we hear from Stefan in Austria, who writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave, and greetings from the home of psychoanalysis. I've been listening to your show for quite some time, and I have to say that it is by far the most interesting podcast I've found on iTunes so far." Hey, thank you, Stefan. That's great news. "I just heard that you invest about 10 hours per show, and I'm not surprised. I think it's great that you put in all that effort for apparently no other reward than emails of praise such as this one. I hope you will stick to Dr. Sheely's advice, though, and buy one of those mini trampolines and get your old bike going again. Hey, thanks for your concerns about my health." They're justified. "I really enjoy hearing about all those border areas of psychology. I've been interested in the whole body and mind issue for quite a long time. I mainly work with traditional systems such as Qigong, meditation, martial arts, and yoga. Your podcast provided very useful insight into other disciplines and interesting follow-ups. I was very surprised to discover so many people with a great academic career who ventured into such exotic and, quotes, unscientific realms as shamanism, intuitive healing, and so on. I think that with all your openness for such unusual approaches, your healthy skepticism is one of your strong points. From all I know from your shows, you're particularly interested in dreams. That's true. I had a few very unusual dreams that seemed very significant to me, unusual in the sense that the quality of the experience was unlike anything else I ever experienced in any other state of mind. Actually, I felt like I was rather awake than dreaming in most of them. I would like to tell you about a recent one. First, there was some regular dreaming that was obviously related to something I had read about before I went to bed. Then I sort of woke up. I was lying in bed with my girlfriend beside me. I was in a relaxed state of mind. I usually don't suffer like other people when I can't sleep. I just lie in bed and let my thoughts and images drift by. That went on for quite some time with different insignificant imagery coming up. Then I saw a little hut on a grassy hill. Perhaps there was a little creek, too. Then the perspective changed as if I was turning around, and I saw an inconspicuous three-story building with three balconies on a slope next to the hut. I did not recognize these buildings. Suddenly, I felt a very, very strong wave of excitement rushing up through my body, up into my head, and then a flash of light inside my head. The feeling was neutral. It was not joyful or fearful, just exciting and very strong. I had never experienced such a flash of light. That's all. As I said, it was the quality of the experience that was absolutely unusual. I got a copy of Gail Delaney's book on dream work that someone recommended in one of your shows, and I intend to delve deeper into that subject. Conscious dreaming is also used in advanced Taoist Qigong and in the Buddhist system that I currently work with. I didn't plan to write such a long message, but I hope you enjoyed it anyway, and of course I would be happy to get some critical feedback on my dream experience. With best regards, Stefan. Stefan, thanks so much for taking time to write such a thoughtful and informative note. I really appreciate it. From time to time, I've had very powerful dreams of my own, in which it was like I was experiencing an altered state of consciousness within the already altered state of consciousness known as sleep and dreaming. You mention conscious dreaming, and certainly your dream has something of that feel, of what we call lucid dreaming. You also mentioned my exploration of shamanism, and I have to say that your dream reminded me of an exercise we did in one of the shamanic training workshops I attended earlier this year. And there we did a shamanic journeying into the past, and I got the feeling from your dream that it might be a journey into the past. The rush of energy that you felt, which ended with a flash of light, brought to mind the energy of Kundalini. It might be that your Qigong and other Taoist and Buddhist practices are activating that energy. Also, Jung distinguishes between little dreams, ordinary dreams, and big archetypal dreams. Now, I've had some big dreams, and I tend to look at those as gifts. I don't know what they mean, and I get the sense that they don't want to be analyzed, but they fill me with wonder, and that's always a gift. And I wonder if this dream felt like a big dream to you. Hearing your dream about the three-story building immediately brought to mind three levels of being, for example, mind, body, and spirit, or the lower unconscious, the conscious, and the higher unconscious. Those are dimensions I'd reflect on if it were my dream. And to me, balconies are places where one can step out and get a view of the land. So in my dream, the three balconies at three different levels would represent three levels of understanding or three levels of outlook on the world that are available to me. I wonder if any of my reflections resonate at all for you. Next, we have an email from Javier, or it might be Javier. Javier. Javier doesn't say where he's located, but your name is exotic enough that it makes me think you might be in another country. I'd love to know. At any rate, Javier writes, "Hi, I love your show. I was wondering if you had any information on business psychology. I mean, how psychologists help in the business atmosphere, how companies keep their employees happy, how psychologists are involved in the workplace, if they are. Do companies have this as an option? Sometimes I wish my company that I work for did. I had all sorts of girl relationship issues, and it often affected my work day and work performance. If my company had one, then I could have talked to a psychologist and gone on with my day. Thanks again for your show. I love to learn more about psychology. Javier. Hi, Javier. Thanks so much for taking time to write. We have had some past shows that touch on psychology in the workplace. For example, we've had episodes relating to leadership in the workplace and also psychological applications of market research. But I think you're asking about employer-provided counseling or psychotherapy services. And I think some companies used to have on-site psychological counseling. The economy's gotten so tight, I'm not sure if that's available anymore. They would have to be very large companies if they did provide those sorts of services. And then there's the whole issue of employee confidentiality. And some employees might fear that their private concerns would get leaked back to management. So I think today, generally, it would be handled by health insurance. Do you have a health insurance plan at your company, and are you covered? And if so, counseling sessions might be covered, at least partially, by that plan. So thanks so much for writing, and keep listening. That's all the mail we have for today. Let me remind you that we thrive on your email, and you can send it to shrinkwrapradio.com. We have at least one new addition that I'm aware of to our Shrink Wrap Radio community, and it's Sonia, an American living in Norway. And I know about this because Sonia signed up on our Frapper map, so I want to encourage others to sign up on Frapper. Don't forget, you can win a free autographed copy of the book I co-authored, in which I profile the infamous Zodiac serial killer. And at the end of this year, I'm going to randomly choose somebody who's signed up on Frapper and send them the book, regardless of where they might be living in the world. And all you have to do to enter is put yourself on our Frapper map by going to frappr.com/shrinkwrapradio, or you'll find a link on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. And don't forget, you can buy the domain name iwantafreebook.com from GoDaddy.com for just $6.95 for a whole year by using the discount code SHRINK3 at checkout.
Hi everybody, this is Sylvia from LA, and you're on the couch, on a rock, on a boat, on a plane with Dr. Dave.
Sylvia may be in California now, but clearly she's originally from Italy, and that's where I'm bound. I'll be getting on a plane for Rome tomorrow afternoon, and I'll be gone for 2 weeks. Please feel free to follow Sylvia's example by clicking on the My Chingo logo on the shrinkwrapradio.com webpage and recording a nice transition or leaving other audio feedback. And remember, you can send your emails even while I'm traveling, and I'll get them, to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can leave voicemails on Skype where our name is ShrinkPod. And don't forget that you will find us also at shrinkwrapradio.podshow.com if you're looking for another way to get to this information. Once again, we would appreciate any help you can give us in growing our audience by spreading the word about Shrink Wrap Radio to your friends, your colleagues. If you've got a podcast or a blog or a MySpace or a LinkedIn page, give us a plug. And to wrap things up, thanks again to our Australian friends, Frank Small and the Reverend Christopher Hughes, for their interview. It only seems fitting to close with some didgeridoo music. The didgeridoo is an Australian Aboriginal instrument which I've been feeling quite drawn to. In fact, I recently attended a didgeridoo festival and purchased a very nice one there. I'm still working on the circular breathing technique, however, and I tried to record a bit of my playing for you, but it didn't sound very good. So instead, we'll close with the only pod-safe didge music I could find. The tune is called Chomp, and it's played by a group out of Munich, Germany called Termites at Work. You'll find a link to this tune in our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Arrivederci. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Out.